Tonight, I'm very happy to have back at Many Rivers Laura Duggan. She is an avid meditator and champion of contemplative life. She studied for many years with Muktananda and Chidvilasananda. You founded the Sanskrit Institute, or you were the first director of an institute to translate Sanskrit texts into English. And tonight, she is going to be talking about mystics in our midst. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for coming out. So I know there's a lot of action happening on the square tonight, including Bollywood dancing, which is hard to pass up, but I'm glad you're here. And I wanted to tell you first a little bit about, for a second, why this talk came about. It happened a couple of months ago when I was, I think it might have been here at the bookstore, and I was listening to a wonderful talk, and it was a little bit about, I don't even remember whose talk it was, but it was something about how meditation and stuff helps you, spiritual practices help you deal with daily life, and you become a better person, and you're not so mean, and how you want to be present and mindful. And it was all actually very good stuff. But something in me said, yeah, but what about those transcendental experiences? What about the juice that comes from just like transcending it all? And so I felt like I wanted to make a case for mystics and give them equal time. And so that's why I'm doing the talk tonight. It's kind of a celebration of mystics. And it's also a celebration of my book. I've just published a book called Inquiring Life, and I'll be reading a couple of excerpts from that. So it's kind of a joyful evening for me to be here and share it with all of you. So are mystics part of the American culture, or is it totally gone? The way I decided to find out was I went to the pulse of American culture. I used Google. And I Googled the word mystic, and I was thrilled. Because the very first line that came up was the first entry on Google was Washington mystics. And I assumed, oh my gosh, it means there's some mystics in Washington, D.C. that are going to influence the way the government works. It was like such a positive experience. So I went to the Washington mystics website. They're a fifth place team in the women's NBA. But not to be dismayed, I explored the rest of their website to see, and I was amazed because their logo, in addition to having the word mystics and basketball underneath, their logo has the word believe. And I thought, how cool, because that's what I feel the heart of a mystic is, that there's someone who believes, not necessarily that they'll be first place in the women's NBA, but that they believe in the unseen worlds. And that's really, to me, the bottom line. That there's a belief that something other than what we can see with our eyes and hear with our ears and touch with our hands, something else exists. That's my working definition of a mystic. Does it matter if we believe in the unseen worlds? If you're on a spiritual path, if you're a seeker, I believe it does matter. There's a Sufi story that I'd like to share. It's about Malik Dinar, who was turned out to be a great Sufi mystic. But in his early days, he was looking for a teacher and wandering. And he came across a dervish, and a dervishes are the Sufi mystics in disguise. You don't kind of know who they are. Came across a dervish and he said, I'm looking for the highest teachings. I really want to find a great guru to work with. Do you know anything? And the dervish looked at him and said, I don't know anything about anything, but you're welcome to walk with me. So they began walking, and very soon they came past a tree, and the dervish put his ear to the tree and he said, the tree says there's a thorn that's hurting it. We need to take it out. And Malik Dinar said, trees and thorns, come on, we've got to go find this master. I don't have time for this. And so they walked on, but in a few minutes there was this commotion, and Malik Dinar turned behind him, and there were the villagers holding buckets, and there was honey pouring out of the tree. They had overheard the dervish pull the thorn out, and got their reward. They kept walking, and they came past a rock, and the dervish knelt down, and he said to Malik Dinar, "The ants say that this rock is blocking them. We have to do something about it." And Malik Dinar said, "Ants, rocks, what's the matter with you? I'm trying to get the highest teachings." So they walked on, and again, in a matter of moments, there was this commotion. They turned around, and the villagers were handing out pieces of gold. They had overheard it. They'd moved the rock, and there was a big pot of gold underneath the rock. Malik Dinar kind of has this look on his face, and he looks at the dervish, and they keep going. They come to a river that they have to cross. They're waiting for the boatman, and a fish jumps up. And the dervish says, "Oh my gosh, the fish says that he's choking on a stone. We need to give him some herbs." Malik Dinar has nothing of it. He says, "We can't wait. Look, here's the boatman." They get on, they cross the river. They're about to lie down and go to sleep, and the boatman comes over with a loud roar. "Look at this," and he's holding this ruby. He said, "I overheard what you said, and I gave some herbs to the fish, and look what he coughed up." At this point, Malik Dinar had enough. He turns to the dervish and he said, "I don't get it. You knew all of this all along, but you've been speaking to me in riddles. You've been speaking in a way I don't understand." And the dervish said, "Precisely. Until you understand the miracles that are all around you in daily life, you can find the greatest teacher you want, but you won't understand a thing. You haven't even become the smallest disciple of life." And with that, of course, Malik Dinar had found his teacher. I like that story. I just like it. I don't know why. I think it says a lot about how we can get confused about what we're looking for. And, you know, to be a mystic and believe in the unseen world is to believe that the ordinary things that happen are not ordinary. They are miraculous in every sense of the word. While I was working on this talk, I really wanted to find that particular story. I couldn't remember where it was. I'd heard my teacher tell it. I looked in all my notes. I looked in all my books. I just could not remember it. And at that moment, I had been going at this. I was even on the internet Googling for the story. The phone rang. It was a friend of mine who had lived in the ashram at the same time I had. And I said, "Do you remember the story about the dervish that Grandma used to tell?" And sure enough, she knew it. We knew what book it was, and we got it. Mm-hmm. Is that a coincidence? Or is there an unseen force that moves things to provide assistance when we need it? You can decide for yourself how to see it. Hi, welcome. There's cures everywhere. George Eliot said this: "If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary human life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heart beat, and we should die of that roar which lies on the other side of silence. If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heart beat." One of our contemporary mystics, I believe, is Mary Oliver. I forgot to say that I'm going to just share all my favorite mystics tonight, their poetry. Why not? It's called At the Lake. "A fish leaps like a black pin, then, when the starlight strikes its side, like a silver pin. In an instant, the fish's spine alters the fierce line of rising, and it curls a little. The head, like scalloped tin, plunges back, and it's gone. This is, I think, what holiness is, the natural world, where every moment is full of the passion to keep moving. Inside every mind, there's a hermit's cave, full of light, full of snow, full of concentration. I've knelt there, and so have you, hanging on to what you love, to what is lovely. The lake's shining sheets don't make a ripple now, and the stars are going off to their deep blue sleep. But the words are in place, and the fish leaps and leaps again from the black plush of the poem, that breathless space. Inside every mind, there's a hermit's cave, full of light, full of snow, full of concentration. I've knelt there, and so have you. Haven't you? It's such a beautiful, I just love it. So beautiful. And when she says inside every mind, if it's inside every mind, every one of us has the capacity to access the mystical worlds. It's not something special. It's there. It's part of us. And it's my conviction that meditation is actually the means that helps us find the way in. Why is it my conviction? Well, because it's my experience. And why is it my experience? Well, about 30 years ago, I lived a very lovely material life. I may have shared this before, but I was a computer programmer, raising a family, and I only understood what I could see and hear, and especially what I could think. And then I met my meditation teacher, meditation master Swami Muktananda, who was a mystic in his own right. And he had a program to give initiation into the spiritual path. And during that event, he gave us meditation instructions about watching the space between the breath. And then he said something I'll never forget. He said, lose yourself in meditation. Lose yourself in meditation. And don't worry, if you get lost, I'll find you. Now, being the skeptic and non-mystic that I was, that sounded, I didn't know what to make of it, actually. But I began to follow his instructions, and as we were meditating, I watched as the breath came in and the breath went out. And then there was a moment where I was lost. There was no hall full of people. There was no body. There was no sound, except I felt like I was in the core of wherever the breath comes in and out of. I would call it the heart. I was in the heart, and somehow the breath was coming in and out from there. And there were big spaces of utter silence with no breath moving at all. And I was utterly at peace, quite happy. And when I came out of the meditation, my life was transformed. Because I literally knew for a fact that I was consciousness. There was an I that was not what I thought I was. And that kind of a taste, you never forget. Because then whatever happens in the world, you know there's something else deep inside you. Inside every mind, there's a hermit's cave full of light, full of snow, full of concentration. Let's just take a moment and we'll have a short meditation to enter our own cave. Inside every mind, there's a hermit's cave full of light, full of snow, full of concentration. Take a comfortable posture and just close your eyes gently. And begin to watch the movement of your breath without doing anything to the breath. Become aware of the place where the incoming breath pauses for a moment and then goes out again. You may not even notice a pause, but just see if you can find where the breath coming in becomes the breath going out. And watch the outgoing breath and see if you can find the place where the outgoing breath dissolves and becomes the incoming breath.
There are two minute spaces in between. Put your attention on the space where the in-breath becomes the out-breath. And the out-breath becomes the in-breath. And give attention to that space in such a way that you could imagine, if you saw that space clearly, something mystical might arise. Watch it with that much focus. Inside every mind, there's a hermit's cave, full of light, full of snow, full of concentration. In addition to believing in the unseen world, which is, I believe, a mark of mystics, they also believe in the oneness of everything, and more importantly, the capacity to experience that oneness directly. Whether you're a mystic in the Sufi tradition, which is a substream of Islam, or a student of the Kabbalah, which is the mystical substream of Judaism, or perhaps a Vedantin from the Hindu tradition, or a Christian mystic, whatever mystical tradition you have an affinity towards, experiencing and believing in oneness seems to be common. The Upanishads, which form the basis of Vedanta in Indian tradition, say this: Where one sees nothing but the One, hears nothing but the One, knows nothing but the One, there is the infinite. Where one sees another, hears another, knows another, there's the finite. The infinite is immortal. The finite is mortal. To the illumined soul, the infinite self is all. For him who sees oneness everywhere, how can there be delusion or grief? For him who sees oneness everywhere, how can there be delusion or grief? I don't know. How can there be? Here's another modern mystic, Byron Katie. Some of you may be familiar with her. I heard a story from someone who studied with her that in the beginning she was just so out there that they had to kind of rein her in. And now she just kind of teaches this psychological level of dealing with your thoughts, and it's terrific. But there's a real mystic in there. And listen to what she says about oneness. Byron Katie. She's been She's taught here, not in Sebastopol, but in the area a couple of times. She said, she writes, I used to believe that there was a you and a me. Then I discovered that there's no you, that in fact you are me. There aren't two to take care of, or three, or four, or a billion. There's only one. The relief of that, it's enormous. Nothing can limit or circumscribe you. You're all of it. You're all that you can possibly imagine. Inside, outside, up, down. Nothing exists that doesn't come out of you. Do you understand? If it doesn't come out of you, it cannot exist. What are you manifesting? Stars? Universes? A tree? A bird? A stone? Who is the thinker? Take a look. Did anything exist before you thought it? When you're asleep and not dreaming, where's the world? When I first realized there was only me, I began to laugh, and the laughter ran deep. I preferred reality to denial, and that was the end of sorrow. That's very cool. So mystics, they believe in the unseen world, they experience oneness, and I also believe they see the hand of God in everything, the hand of the divine, or the hand of the universe. That doesn't really matter what you call it, the hand of Buddha. But they see that there's another force that moves things around and makes things happen. And I personally like that as an experience. I wouldn't call myself a mystic in the sense that I'm mostly down here on this planet interacting, but there are moments where I see that I have tendencies like that. Mystical tendencies, I think, is a nice way to put it. I was struggling about where to live and thinking I had to move because my house was a little expensive and I couldn't afford it, and started searching on Craigslist. And then some construction started on the property I live on, and the landlord's emailed me and gave me a 20% rent reduction. And my first reaction was, wow, God doesn't really think I should move. I mean, it was such a clear sense that it wasn't anything I did, that I was being taken care of, and that my pleas for what should I do about my financial situation were handled. That was my experience. And I don't always, or I don't only think that way when something good happens. I actually feel that way during difficult situations as well. I'd like to share a reading from my new book, which I introduced earlier. Mm-hmm. The way the book is laid out is there's a quote by somebody terrific, either a poet or a, you know, Rumi or a Hafiz or a Buddha or somebody like that. There's a quote, and then there's my daily experience related to the quote. And then at the end, there's a suggested contemplation that you can do yourself to work with the quote. So the one I'd like to read starts with a quote by Hafiz, a Sufi poet. Come, join the courageous who have no choice but to bet their entire world that indeed, indeed, God is real. What does the Sufi poet Hafiz mean when he says, bet their entire world? And what does he mean, God is real? It is amazing how one line of poetry can be open to so many possibilities. God is a word that can stop many people from even reading any further. However, recently I read a way of describing God as whatever you believe the highest principle in the universe to be. We all believe in something. We could be materialists who believe in the physical world, and the physical world's the beginning and end of everything. In that case, our God is material. Or we could believe in emptiness, as in the Buddhist tradition, and emptiness becomes our God. For Sufis, God is love. I think Hafiz is pointing to the fact that no matter what you believe in, when you believe in it, you will put everything up against it. But how do we know our God, in quotes, is real? One way is when it is put to test in our life. 2 weeks ago, in a sudden and unexpected event, my dear cat Pumpkin lost his life. I was sad, bereaved, and bereft. Simultaneously, I felt surrounded by pure love, the presence of the divine. I knew without a doubt there was a power greater than birth and death, good and bad, a benevolent hand of the universe rearranging my world. While the event was not something I ever wished for, I had a deep trust it would be for the good of all. In that moment, I was able to bet my entire world that indeed God is real, love is real. It was a moment of courage, choosing to move to the highest way of viewing things, despite the sadness of it. And then there's a contemplation that follows, and I thought we could just try it for a moment. You can close your eyes. We spent a long time on it, and then you can take it with you. So just take a moment and close your eyes. The contemplation this week is to work with Hafiz's words. What is it that you believe in? What is it that you believe in? How do you know it is real? And how does that knowledge affect your life? What is it you believe in? How do you know it is real? And how does that knowledge affect your life? May your contemplation reveal the benevolence that truly lies at the heart of this world. You can carry that with you for the week. See what turns up. Or afterwards you can share with one of your friends. The mystic sees the hand of God in everything. I have a friend who's a monk. He's been a monk for 30 years. And he came to the West Coast a few weeks ago. And I was sharing with him some of the wonderful meditation techniques I've been learning in a variety of traditions, mostly wonderful Buddhist traditions. And he got very interested and he said something very important to me. He said, you know, it's not about the mind. It's not about the mind. You can learn all these techniques and do things step by step, but it's bigger than that. It's not what you can think about. And then he went on to add, when someone dies, you see that there's something bigger. That's one of those mystical moments in your life when you realize you have no idea what life and birth and death are all about. The mystic gives credit to the divine at all times. This friend of mine, this monk, is quite amazing. He reminds me of the dervish. When he came to visit, he had these series of things happen. And when I pointed it out to him, he looked at me like, huh? You know, they're no big deal to him. He first arrived and he had to meet with some people and he was thinking about them and what he would say. And he wasn't sure when he was going to be able to see them. And he walked out of the building he was staying in and there they were walking down the street. Then he went up to Berkeley to get some tea, but it was too early for the tea shop to open, and as he got to the door, the owner was arriving to unlock the door an hour early and let him in. And then later, when I arrived at the ashram to pick him up, I parked my car. I got out of my car. He walked out of the door. I said, how did you know I was coming now? He said, I just felt it was time. But when I tried to put all this together and say, whatever you think manifests, he kind of like thought I was a bit stupid for making a big thing of it. Because literally for him, this is just what the universe does. There's no personal ego taking credit for it. And I think that's the third hallmark of a mystic. There's nobody home. There's really nobody home. There's not, oh, I am a mystic, and look how the world is responding to my thoughts. It just doesn't work that way. In fact, they say that many mystics are much more childlike, often foolish. I read a beautiful Christian writing, Thérèse de Lisieux. Do you know Thérèse de Lisieux? I think she's called Little Flower, no? She was very childlike, and when she became a saint in the 1920s, Pope Pius XI wrote about her. And it was so beautiful. I didn't expect popes to be so mystical. But the whole essay was very, his whole talk was very beautiful. But he wrote this. He said, when his disciples asked him who would be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, Jesus called a child and set it in the midst of them and spoke these memorable words. I say to you, unless you be converted and become as little children, you shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Then he went on to say, the new Saint Thérèse was penetrated by this doctrine and put it into practice every day of her life. More than that, she taught this way of spiritual childhood by her words and her example. I just love that way of spiritual childhood. Now, we could put it down because we're Westerners and we're meant to be grown up and we're not meant to be children, but there's something very sweet about that, thinking about the relationship to the divine in that way. How would a Taoist put it? Here's what Chuang Tzu says about becoming empty. Who can free himself from achievement and fame, descend and be lost among the masses of men? He will flow like the Tao, unseen. He will go about like life itself, with no name and no home. Simple is he, without distinction. To all appearances, he is a fool. His steps leave no trace. He has no power. He achieves nothing, has no reputation. Since he judges no one, no one judges him. Such is the perfect man. His boat is empty. And there's a wonderful Sufi poem that goes, Jangala, jangala, pir divane. I won't sing it, but I'll just read you a little piece of it. From forest to forest, O mad one, disintegrate into the tiniest particle. Become such a vagabond that every grain of sand in the widest of deserts could constantly search for you and still never find you. Enter the living heart that throbs within your chest and lose yourself there. Then feel your vision expand as a drop of water expands when it loses itself in a river. O you who feel you are a drop, become that river. Although I am no one, I am nothing, I have created the hues of the infinite universe of names and forms. The world instructs me, become this, become that, become this, become that. By becoming no one, I have found myself in all. Jangala, jangala, pir divane. Well, if you become nothing, then the question is, how do you live in the world? That's a tricky question. There's actually I'm not going to read it because I forgot to mark it. There's a wonderful passage in Byron Katie where she talks about realizing that she kind of scared everybody, and so she had to get herself to the point where she just looked normal. And I think that's one of the secrets of the mystics. You can't really tell who's a mystic and who's not because they become quite ordinary. But what do they do? Here's what Kabir says about living in the world. He practices what's called in the Indian tradition Sahaj Samadhi. Samadhi is union with God, and Sahaj is the natural state of union with God. So his practice is Sahaj Samadhi. O Sadhu, the simple union is best. Since the day when I met with my Lord, there has been no end to the sport of our love. I close not my eyes, nor my ears. I don't mortify my body. I see with eyes open and smile and behold his beauty everywhere. I utter his name, and whatever I see, it reminds me of him. Whatever I do becomes his worship. Wherever I go, I move around him. All I achieve is his service. Or as Rumi put it, let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. I never thought that Joseph Campbell was mystical, but he is. Did you ever know he was mystical? You did. I've never read a lot of Joseph Campbell, but then I found this passage by him and I was totally awestruck. Listen to what he says. Live from your own center. The divine lives within you. The separateness apparent in the world is secondary. Beyond the world of opposites is an unseen but experienced unity and identity in us all. Today, the planet is the only proper in-group. Participate joyfully in the sorrows of the world. We cannot cure the world of sorrows, but we can choose to live in joy. You must return with the bliss and integrate it. The return is seeing the radiance everywhere. The world is a match for us. We are a match for the world. The spirit is the bouquet of nature. Sanctify the place you are in. Follow your bliss. Sanctify the place you're in. So it seems to me that they're all saying the same thing, that a mystic has that experience but then comes back and is in the world and brings the joy of that to everything instead of leaving it behind. And I love what he said here about we cannot cure the sorrows, but we can choose to live in joy. My teacher, Swami Muktananda, was once with a group of Christian monks, and before their interview ended, they said to him, what do we tell the people about all the sorrow and suffering in the world? There's so much suffering. And Muktananda looked at them with great compassion, and he said, they know about the suffering. Tell them about the joy. And I think that's the role of a mystic. You can open the newspaper if you want to hear about suffering. We're not turning our back on it, but I want to make a case for honoring the transcendental experiences. It's not that you can depend on them to happen. You can't even make them happen. They happen by who knows what, grace. But don't push them away. And allow yourself to be open to them. Because for me, personally, if I don't touch that space every so often, I forget that there's something else. And all the rest of it starts to get to me. I have to know this world is not completely real. Paramahansa Yogananda, Indian mystic, he said, mystics are those who are half awake and half dreaming. On one side, awake in God, and on the other side, dreaming the dream of incarnation. But they can get quickly out of that dream. You have to be able to get out of it. There's an interesting poem by Rumi, which I hope you can... It took me a few times to get it, but I'll read it slowly. He's talking about, I think, the same thing of why you need to have the inner worlds as well as the outside. He says, outside, the freezing desert night. This other night inside grows warm, kindling. Let the landscape be covered with thorny crust. We have a soft garden in here. The continents blasted, cities and little towns, everything becomes a scorched, blackened ball. The news we hear is full of grief for that future. But the real news inside here is there's no news at all. The news we hear is full of grief for that future, but the real news inside here is there's no news at all. I believe we have to allow ourselves to immerse ourselves in other states from time to time to keep our sanity, to keep in touch. And when we know that, what happens? Why don't we? There's a Rumi poem, just an excerpt of it. He says, "Either give me enough wine or leave me alone, now that I know how it is to be with you in constant conversation. Either give me enough wine or leave me alone, now that I know how it is to be with you in constant conversation." I like that because what it reminds me of is we know that experience, but then we can't hold it. We don't stay there. What happens? I think personally what happens is I just get caught up in the world, and I need an hour of meditation in the morning to really go deep. But suddenly, 45 minutes will be okay. And then before you know it, 20 minutes, I need to get out of the house. And then, I'll do 10 minutes every day. And, you know, within a month, your whole state disappears. Until one day you sit again and you think, where have I been? What is this all about? So it's our own effort to stay there and keep the soul alive. I'd like to read from this lovely book. It's good when you love your own stuff, actually. I think that's why I wrote it. These, by the way, came on my website. People have been signing up for contemplations that come every 3 weeks, and so I've been doing contemplations for the past 3 years, and then decided to gather 2 years worth of them into 1 year's worth for a book. So that's where it came from. So this one starts with a quote from Emily Dickinson: "The soul should always stand ajar, ready to welcome the ecstatic experience." Sitting to meditate this morning, my mind was restless and my heart was dry. There were so many other things I wanted to do. Sitting felt as if I were wasting time. I began to rationalize that maybe I expressed my love for God through my actions in the world and didn't really need to meditate. However, rationalization didn't erase the knowledge that under other circumstances, meditation felt sublime. I was feeling restless and disconnected. As I continued to struggle between meditating and giving up, I remembered a children's story I had just read. A professor teaches three children how to get to a magical land using their imaginations. They successfully reach the kingdom and are about to meet the magical king when the professor tells them to go ahead without him. He cannot see the bridge leading to the castle. He realizes his mind is being pulled back by all his worldly responsibilities, and he is losing his connection to the magical world. The youngest of the children is able to lead him across the bridge, where they all happily meet the king. Oh, how similar it felt to the meditation experience I was having. I knew the mystical inner kingdom existed, yet I was unable to reach it. I patiently made an effort to turn my mind towards my breath, watching where the breath arises and where it subsides. I imagined the presence of my teacher nearby. I broke the chain of impatience and gently led my mind back to the goal of meditation. Like the innocent child leading the professor, the heart leads the mind. And like a faithful companion, the sweetness of the mystical lands returned. The sensation of the body dissolved, and the experience of light filled my awareness. Light was everywhere. Breath became the smallest pulsation of movement in a field of light. Everything in me melted into soft energy, floating in consciousness. I felt as if I had drawn a warm bath and finally stepped into it instead of staring at its surface. It's easy to think deep meditation is something that happens of its own accord. However, my lesson today is that it takes my own willing effort and patience. The mystical lands are always there. The mystical lands are always there. It's up to us to believe in the yearning of our hearts to visit them. Let's take a few moments to have a short meditation again. You can close your eyes. And begin watching your breath. The soul should always stand ajar, ready to welcome the ecstatic experience. Allow your mind to rest in that silent space between the incoming breath and the outgoing breath. There's nothing to do but just rest there. we could just sit all night, but we won't.
I'd like to end by reading another Sufi poem that my teacher Gurmai often sang in its original language. This is the translation. O traveler, recognize, recognize, recognize your master. Because of the narrowness of your heart, you think God is nowhere to be found. Expand your heart, and you will find him in every garden, acting through every hand. See him in bright colors and faded colors, and in that which is devoid of hue. See him in your journey, in your destination, and in everyone you meet along the way. In every street, whatever your business may be, see him in all you encounter. Since he is in your resolve, in your determination, strive to see his radiance in the rhythms of nature. See him in honor, in custom, in every gesture. If you are a true lover, if you are a true lover, then recognize your beloved in every color. Take John, recognize. That's the key. I encourage you all to keep having those leanings in the mystical direction. And as we end tonight, before Jim does his closing announcements, I'll share a few things. Up here, of course, you can look through this book, and it's being shipped as we speak. It's actually left Tennessee and is somewhere between Tennessee and here. So if you'd like to buy an advance copy, we have a sign-up sheet there. And we'd love to offer you, if you buy it tonight, in honor of you being the very first people to even hear about it and buy it, we'll give you a 10% discount on the price. And you can pick it up in the store when it arrives, which should be next week, or I can mail it to you. That's one announcement. And the second announcement is, if you'd like to receive these contemplations, which are still going on, by email, you're welcome to sign up on this sign-up sheet. Just check the box for inquiring life contemplations. Or if you'd like to be on the email list for the Freestone Retreat Center, which is at my place when we hold events, you can check that. They are not the same list, so you have to check both boxes. And here's some cards with the website, in case you just want to look at the website. So thank you very much for coming. Mm-hmm.